Welcome to PRN, Pause, Renew, Next, a podcast about soul care, scripture, and stories of faith. I'm Jenny Detweiler, and friends, I really like to think of PRN as being at the intersection of faith and mental health, and today's episode is definitely that. It was a joy to get to talk to author Brittany Tinsley about her new book, Stories Our Scars Tell, Hope, Healing, and Honesty About the Wounds We Carry. Brittany, in her book and in this podcast, shares some of her wisdom and experience around the topic of self-injury and self-harm. Now, I realize that that topic has the potential to have a lot of triggers involved, but I really think in this conversation we show a lot of care, and I really think that there are not a lot of triggers involved in this conversation. So I encourage you, whether you have personal experience with this topic, whether you know somebody who does, or whether this is kind of a new thing that you've never ventured into, I encourage you to listen all the way through. This is a topic that probably doesn't get enough airtime. It's something that happens very frequently and really doesn't get talked about in a lot of spaces. And so I'm so thankful for Brittany's honesty and vulnerability and wisdom. So with that, let's jump into the conversation. Well, welcome, Brittany, to the podcast. I'm so glad to have you. Would you like to share a little bit about yourself, your ministry, your life, whatever you'd like to share with people?
Yeah, thanks so much for having me. I'm really excited to be here. I'm Brittany Tinsley, and I'm a writer, and I just released my first book. It's called Stories Our Scars Tell, but outside of writing, I'm a mom and a wife. I've got two kids who I homeschool and schlep around all over creation to all sorts of activities. And so most of my time is spent with them. But I also do this writing gig on the side where I write mostly at the intersection of faith and mental health. And so this book that I've just released is situated there. And it's about hope and healing told through the lens of my own story with self-injury.
Faith and mental health is right at the intersection of this podcast too. So you're the perfect guest, and I'm really glad that we get to talk. Can you share a little bit about your story and what led you to write this book?
Yeah, so I started self-injuring when I was 15, which at this point was almost 20 years ago, which feels a little ridiculous to say out loud. But it was something that I sort of fell into on accident. I thought I had kind of invented it. I didn't know it was something that anybody struggled with, but I had a friend who died by suicide my freshman year of high school, and I was just eaten alive by the guilt that went along with that and started using self-injury as a way to cope. And over the next several years of high school, that was what I did. Eventually, it kind of got out of control, and so I told on myself. I told a pastor and was not met with a great reaction, and was asked to leave our church. For the most part, I was told I was welcome on Sunday mornings and Wednesday nights when everybody else was there, but that outside of that, I was not welcome at any of the youth group activities or events or anything. And so that was really challenging to hear and was sort of the first moment where I had this realization that like mental health and the church didn't necessarily know how to interact with each other in like a good way sometimes. My family moved and I continued self-injuring through the rest of high school and into college. And that whole time, just I had this sense, because I was a strong Christian and always had been, that one day God would use my story for good at some point. You know, he tells us he works all things for good. And I really believed that. But in my head, I thought it's going to be in like some one-on-one conversation with some teenager, you know, 30 years down the line. And I'm just going to have an opportunity to speak to like this one human being who's really struggling. And instead, God was like, actually, how about you write a book about it? How about you talk about this in like a really public way? And so there was a lot of wrestling that went along with that and a lot of work on my part in order to be in a place where I was able to even write a book from a good, you know, a mental, emotional place. But that's sort of what led to it, was just this really ongoing struggle in the sense that there were people who are like me, are Christian, who have struggled, who are being told that the way that they struggle is a sign of a lack of faith, or that they're not praying enough or doing enough, or that it's this really shameful moral failing, or, you know, just there's so many harmful messages out there. And so I felt like I was sort of uniquely positioned to speak into that in a way that just a lot of people aren't able to or aren't willing to, because at the end of the day, it still is something that's really stigmatized and that remains hidden for a lot of people. And so here I am. I wrote a book.
And I'm really glad. Before we started recording, I was telling you I'm a therapist, and I feel like this is a subject that does not get talked about enough, yeah. Probably even in mental health circles, but especially not in the church. And yeah. I think there are certain behaviors, certain symptoms, however you want to call it, certain coping devices that tend to be a little scarier to people than others, mm-hmm. you know? And Absolutely. There are, self-injury is one of them. That's not the only one. But I think when caregivers or other people hear something like that, mm-hmm. it is very alarming, like scary. And yeah. sometimes they don't handle it very well of like what yeah. they should do. Yeah. I hear sure. you. Mm-hmm. And I'm really sorry that that happened to you.
That's okay. You know, I think that so many people hear it and immediately go, their brain goes to suicide and they think it's a suicide attempt or right. that it's a precursor to a suicide attempt. And obviously, yes. you know, it can be for some people, like there can be some correlation there, but most of the time it's its own thing. And mm-hmm. so I think that when people's brains immediately jump to suicide, there tends to be some sort of overreaction a lot of the time, or like my pastor saw it, he saw it as a liability and they don't, you know, nobody knows what to do with that. And so it's sort of this, well, I don't know what to do with it. And so we'll pass it off to somebody else kind of problem, or we'll sweep it under the rug, or we won't talk about it. We'll just hope it goes away, or we'll really overreact and hospitalize you, or, you know, something like that. Like there's this fear of this really big overreaction that most of the time, in my experience anyway, was not necessary. So I think a lot of people just don't know what to do with it because they just aren't really informed about it, honestly. And so, you know, I think there's definitely room there for improvement.
And education for sure. Because mm-hmm. you're right. One thing, when you don't know, you don't know. Once yeah. you do know, it's easier to know like how to handle it, what to do about it. What are the signs? What does somebody need when they're in that situation? All that. Mm-hmm. That's why I'm really glad that we're talking about this and that you wrote this book, because you can understand all the sides of that.
Yeah.
Let me ask you, what do you think generally tends to get misunderstood or people tend to get wrong? Besides the suicide thing, which you already mentioned, I do think yeah. that definitely is one of those. But about self-harm and self-injury?
I think that there's this misunderstanding that it's all about attention. You know, people, I think if they don't automatically think suicide, they think, oh, you're doing it for attention. And there's this idea that the only reason that somebody would hurt themselves is to get the attention of people around them. And that's usually not the case. Obviously, everybody has their own motives. And, you know, I can't speak for the whole world at large. But most of the time, most people are not engaging in that behavior because they want attention. Otherwise, they wouldn't keep it so secret and so hidden. And most of us who have struggled with this do keep it really secret and try to keep it really hidden. And we do it not for attention, but because it offers some sort of positive, even though it doesn't seem like it would, some sort of positive outcome, at least temporarily. And so, you know, it makes you feel better, or it numbs everything, or it gives you this sense of control for a split second, or whatever the reason is. Most of the time, it doesn't come down to attention. I did an interview with somebody else years ago about this, and he made the point, and even if it is somebody does fall in that outlier group where they are doing it for attention, if that's the way that they feel like they need to get attention, then shouldn't we just give it to them? Like, why is that such a bad thing? Because obviously they're in a desperate enough place for that to be sort of the only option that they have. But most of the time, I think that people's brains go to the attention thing. And most of the time, that isn't an accurate reflection of the real motive behind the behavior.
Right. Yes. You know, one thing that I'm kind of noticing over like the last 10 years, I would say maybe even 15, but definitely 10, is that we tend to be a little more trauma-informed these days. Yeah. And mm-hmm. that was definitely something when you and I were growing up that somebody would have said, you know.
Oh, yeah.
For sure. For sure. Like, for sure. Oh, those behaviors are acting out, you know. Don't give yeah. them attention. And nowadays, like, we've really shifted. The mental health world especially has really mm-hmm. shifted away from that to, like, regulation versus dysregulation, mm-hmm. trauma-informed care, like behaviors come out because they're meeting a need of some sort.
Yeah.
And I'm really thankful that that lens is beginning to shift, because you're right, that's so not helpful to think about it from an attention standpoint.
Yeah, it just really isn't. And I think also people have this assumption that the only people who engage in self-injury are people who are like dressing in all black all the time, or who are super depressed all the time, or who
emo.
Yeah, you know, like back, you know, back for us, you know, they were the emo kids or whatever. And that also isn't true. Like, yes, there are people in those communities or who dress that way, or who are depressed or whatever, who do self-injure, but also there are plenty of people who don't fit any of those stereotypes who do. When I started, you wouldn't have had any idea from the outside that that was something I was struggling with. Like, I was a straight A student. I was on my school's volleyball team. I had a lot of friends. I had a boyfriend. I was volunteering in 8 million different positions. I was this very like perfectionistic kid, and nobody, I mean, people were shocked when they found out, because it was just, I didn't fit the stereotype. And even now, I think where we are more informed about mental health and we're more willing to have those conversations, there still is sort of that association with that type of person that exists with self-injury specifically. And the reality is, you know, it's not just girls. It's not just teenagers. It's not just people who dress in all black or who are emo or who listen to, you know, emo music or whatever. It can be anybody and everybody, your neighbor, your friend, your kid, your, you know, whoever. So I think that that's something important just to know too, that it doesn't, it's not limited to a certain demographic or stereotype.
Thank you for sharing that. You're exactly right. It's good to keep that in mind. I hadn't even thought about that, but you're right. There is that stereotype for sure.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So talking about church for a minute and mental health and faith, after you told that story about the pastor and everything, mm-hmm. I'm going to read a quote from your book. You write, "Silence like stained glass hangs in our sanctuaries. We shake hands with the people around us during meet and greet interludes, simultaneously praying no one calls our bluff and also hoping someone will."
Mm-hmm.
Why do you think we so rarely share our real struggles with each other in the faith community? And, or, how do you wish people would have handled your story differently?
I think that there are so many reasons why we don't share our real struggles in those communities. I think that we show up to church and, or in, you know, whatever our Christian circles look like, and there's this sort of expectation that you at least sort of have it together, because if you're a Christian or, you know, in these faith communities, then surely you're like better than other people. Surely you have it more together than other people or than the world, or, you know, we're set apart or whatever. And so I think that it makes it really hard sometimes to then come in and say, actually, I'm really struggling. And not only am I really struggling, I'm really struggling with this thing that kind of feels bigger than, you know, my dog is sick. Like, I, you know, I volunteer with little kids, and the prayer requests that they have, you know, it's always like, my dog is sick. My great uncle twice removed is dying, or, you know, whatever. And not that those aren't completely valid prayer requests, but that's a different kind of thing to say out loud than like, hey, all week last week, I really wanted to hurt myself, or all week last week, I was really depressed, or all week last week, you know, fill in the blank. And so I think that we just are hesitant to bring that kind of thing to church, because we don't know what reaction we'll get, because people don't bring that kind of thing to church. And so it's all this very cyclical sort of situation. And so then I think when somebody does actually take the leap to say something real in those circles, there's this moment where like nobody really knows what to do with it, because you feel helpless, or you don't know exactly what kind of help they're looking for, even if you want to help, or it feels so beyond the scope of what you're qualified or capable of helping with, that everybody just sort of sits around and stares at each other and isn't sure what to do. And I think that in my experience, that was sort of where it fell for me, was, you know, I confessed this thing. I thought I was doing what I'd always been taught to do, like bring your struggle to the church. And I mustered up the courage to do it. And then I was met with these people who were like, well, we don't know how to handle this. And so instead of us trying to handle this, we're just going to ask you to leave, because that's easier and more convenient. And, you know, as a 15-year-old, you know, at that point I was 15, like that was a really hard thing to hear. But I don't think it's an easier thing to hear as an adult either, if you're an adult and you're walking into that situation and are met with that kind of reaction. And so I think that the better and more appropriate reaction would be for the people who say that they follow Christ to show up in the way that Christ would, and to show up with compassion and grace and kindness. And even if you don't know exactly how to react, offer to find help, you know, offer to find somebody who does know what they're doing, or to find a resource where they can actually get the help that they need, and be the community that sort of we've all opted into when we sign up to be part of these faith communities actually live that out in the moment when somebody needs it the most. I think that's really the best thing that we can do, because at the end of the day, we all just want to feel loved and understood and accepted by the people around us. And that includes people within faith spaces.
Yeah, I think you're exactly right. One thing that I've realized inside and outside of faith communities, kind of like I said earlier, is that when people have big issues, so to speak, and that can fit a lot of different categories, I'm coming to realize.
Yeah.
And then it feels bigger than the resources that the other person has. There is kind of like a protective thing that can happen where either we get gaslit in a way of like, well, this is a bit, seems like a you problem.
Right.
Like, well, you can't come anymore now that you've told us that, you know, which then sends a shame message to us like, oh, I'm the problem. I am the problem. I've already been telling myself that I was, but now I know for sure. Like, this is a bigger thing than, I mean, that's kind of the message that we get in those circumstances. Like, I knew this was big. I knew this was scary. That's why it's taken me a long time to say it. But now you've given me the message that it for sure is, and I shouldn't say it again.
100%.
Yeah. So here you are in your 30s now.
Yep.
And you are talking about it now. So how did you gain the, how did you get past that? And how did you get to the point where you can advocate a little bit better? Does that make sense?
Yeah. Yeah. I think partially it's just pure stubbornness to tell you the truth, but I, you know, my faith has always been strong. I grew up in a Christian home and came to faith at a really young age. And so, like I said, I always had this sense that like one day God would use this somehow. And I didn't know what that would be or what it would look like, but I've really truly deep down always believed that. And so when I sort of felt like this nudge to start to speak out about it, initially I was really resistant to that. And honestly, like I hadn't done enough work myself to be in a place where that would have been a good or a healthy decision. But that nudge prompted me to go to therapy for the first time as an adult, really for the first time ever. I went very briefly when I was in high school, which I wrote a little bit about in the book. It was not a great experience, but I went to therapy and it was the best decision I ever made for myself. I highly recommend therapy to anybody who needs it and can, you know, and has access to it. I know it's a privilege and not something that everybody's able to do for themselves, but highly recommend if you can. But I started going to therapy and realized that a lot of the things that were sort of wrapped up with this whole self-injury thing went back much further than I would have expected or knew. And so I did a lot of work, and still do a lot of work, to be quite frank about it. And, eventually got to a point where when that nudge came again, I was like, okay, you know what? I think I am in a place where I can talk about this. And if I'm met with a really negative reaction, it's not going to like totally send me off the rails or, you know, off the deep end or whatever. And I saw a call for blogs from To Write Love on Her Arms, which is a mental health nonprofit. And I'd followed them for years and years and years, you know, all the way back into high school, based on the story of the founder who, if you don't know their story, there was a girl who was struggling with self-injury among some other things. And the founder raised money to send her to treatment. And so that was really the first time I'd ever heard anybody talk about self-injury in like a public sort of way. And so when this opportunity came to write a blog for them, I thought, you know what? I have a story to tell. I could write there. I've always kind of been a writer. And so I thought, oh, I'll just write this one little piece and that'll be it. I'll check the box. I'll do it. And so I wrote the piece, not really expecting anything to come from it. And it got accepted and it ended up being like one of their top blogs that year. And it got quite a bit of attention. And from that, this ball sort of just started rolling where I was having these opportunities presented to me to come and speak about this and these invitations to write other articles or to be on other podcasts. And I realized sort of as the whole thing was unfolding that maybe this was actually the direction that things were supposed to be going the whole time. And so I've just walked through those doors as they have opened. And eventually that led to this book. And when I thought about writing the book, I was really hesitant again to do it because it feels a little different to talk about it, you know, in a single article that's 500 words or like a 20-minute podcast or whatever, than it does to write a book and spend years doing it and then have to promote it and, you know, talk about it. And it just feels like it's on a different scope and exists in like a different sphere of things. And so I drug my heels a little bit and eventually you know, was like, okay, I really feel like God is calling me to do this work. And so I'm just going to step into it fully. And so even though I was a little resistant, this is what I've ended up doing. And I don't regret it for a single second. I think that even though it has been maybe the scariest thing I've ever done, it has also been one of the best, both personally, you know, it's been personally healing for me in a lot of ways to write this. But I've also heard from a lot of people who have been really positively impacted, not just by the book. This isn't, you know, a toot your own horn situation, but who have come and told me that like they've never heard a Christian talk about this before. They've never heard somebody in their 30s talk about this before. It's always been teenagers, or they've never, you know, like they see themselves in parts of my story. And I think that that's a really powerful gift that other people have offered me along the way. And so now it's like, it's a really a big honor to get to offer that to other people.
That's really awesome. I'm glad I got to hear that whole story. Yeah. Speaking of therapy, you wrote in your book that your therapist told you not to think of the behavior as good or bad, but instead it's not bad, it's desperate. Do you want to share more about that and how that's helped change your perspective? And also in that same paragraph, you talk about resourcing and things like that. So, I mean, as much as you want to share about that as well, but.
Yeah, that I think is one of the most impactful statements that my therapist has said to me, but also maybe one of the most impactful things anybody has ever said to me, because I think that for most of my life, I have sort of put self-injury into this like moral box where I'm either being a good person by not engaging in that behavior, or I'm being a bad person by engaging in it. And depending on the day, I fell either onto the good side or the bad side of things. And that just, it really messes with you if you're constantly like evaluating yourself in that way based on something that isn't just a choice. And I know that like when I say that, people might bristle a little bit, because it obviously it's an action. And so there is a choice element to it, but at times it feels very uncontrollable and, you know, addictive in nature and things like that. And so it's not like the plain black and white choice that I think a lot of people assume it to be. And so when my therapist said, you know, the fact that you're choosing to hurt yourself, or the fact that you feel the need to hurt yourself, doesn't say anything about your inherent goodness or your inherent badness. It just means you're feeling really desperate, was this really powerful reframe, because suddenly it wasn't that like I was a terrible person. It was that I was in a situation, or the chemicals in my brain were fluctuating in a way that made me feel more desperate than I typically would on a, you know, quote unquote, like good day. And so when she said that, I was like, oh, it's actually not this failing on my part. I'm not, you know, really like messing things up in this huge dramatic way by engaging in this, because it has never been about who I am on an intrinsic level. It just is a signal that something else is going on. And so now, knowing that and sort of having that reframe, when the urge arises, because it still does, and I go, oh, this is a clue to me that I'm feeling desperate. And if I'm feeling desperate, what are some ways that I can work against that desperation, or meet myself in a way that is helpful in that desperation outside of making this choice that I know I'm going to regret later? And so we've done a lot of work on resourcing and what that might look like for me specifically. And, you know, there are 8,000 lists of all the things you can do instead of engaging in self-injury or whatever your vice is. But for me, I had to learn, you know, what things were helpful and what wasn't. And I think in the process of that, something else that was really pivotal for me to learn, and maybe this is common knowledge, it wasn't for me, was that things weren't supposed to automatically take you from like a 10 to a zero.
Right.
I thought, you know, like if I'm trying to color, whatever, if I'm trying to color instead of hurt myself, and it's not taking me from this like 10 all the way down to a zero, then it's not working at all. And clearly I'm this terrible person and nothing works for me and woe is me, or, you know, whatever. And in reality, you know, my therapist was like, actually, Brittany, it's not supposed to take you from a 10 to a zero. We're working on like 10 to nine. And then if you get to nine, then we're working 9 to 8. And, you know, we're going to baby step our way down to hopefully a zero. But you're not, again, you're not bad because you're not going automatically from a 10 to a zero. And that was something about resourcing that, like, I just had, nobody had ever told me that. I didn't have any idea that that was how it was supposed to happen. And so even in that, I had to learn how to really, I think it's all about giving yourself a little bit more grace and just being a little kinder to yourself. And that, you know, who knew? It makes it easier to deal with things when you're not beating yourself up all the time about them.
Right. Exactly. I'm really glad that you said that. Like, all of that was really helpful. I also think the idea of not expecting it. I think sometimes because I'm in the therapist's seat, mm-hmm. sometimes I forget to say that to people. And that's really important that you're right. A lot of people are expecting, like, in order to go from desperation to this relaxed state where I no longer feel this way, I need mm-hmm. it to happen fast.
Yeah.
And I kind of joke with people that have panic attacks, same. It's like, I need this to go away right now, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And like, outside of Xanax, I don't know anything that's going to do that. But but like, we can find some coping, you know, some resourcing that will help us come down. That's what we're trying to do slowly, slowly. Because naturally, that's what our bodies do. We don't tend to flip that quickly from the sympathetic to the parasympathetic nervous system. Yeah.
I keep asking my therapist if she's figured out how to fix that yet, because I feel like y'all should figure this out. Like some sort of magic switch sort of situation where we can just like on off the whole thing. That'd be real great. You guys need to all get together and figure it out for us.
Heaven, friend. I think that's so all we have to look forward to. So we've talked a little bit about shame. But you write some about shame mm-hmm. in your book. And you wrote, shame thrives in secrecy. The hardest parts of our stories benefit from light, which I agree with 100%.
Mm-hmm.
To be honest with ourselves and others is to let light in. And you've mm-hmm. talked a little bit about this already. Mm-hmm. I think the scary thing is that sometimes we try to do that and mm-hmm. it makes it worse, which is what happened with that pastor.
Yeah.
But if we can find safe people, like a therapist, like a trusted friend, like somebody who's knowledgeable mm-hmm. and gentle, then that is the healthiest thing that we can do. What are some ways that you've learned to battle shame and let the light in?
I mean, I think that you hit the nail on the head. Like, it's finding safe people, because my personal tendency is to want to hold things really close and to isolate and to hide things. Like, the harder something is, the more I want to hide it. Even if I don't feel like it's bad, if it just feels hard, I want to hide it because I don't want to have to try to explain it, or I don't want to be a burden, or I don't want people to think negatively of me. You know, we all have these internal messages that we're sending ourselves that make us think that if I just hide this, then people will like me more, or people will be more comfortable around me, or people will have this certain image of who I am. And if I say anything out loud, it's going to mess all of that up. And in reality, a lot of times the opposite is true, because we're all human. And when I open up, it makes you more able to open up to me. And it creates this reciprocity and a relationship that's really beautiful that we don't get unless somebody goes first. But I think that for me and in my life, what I've had to learn is that there actually are safe people. And I don't think that's something that all of us have the privilege of knowing, you know, our entire lives. And so that took a really long time to learn that there actually are people who can hold some of my story with me. And it doesn't have to be all of it. And it doesn't have to be every nitty gritty detail of it. But that when I'm in one of those places that feels really shameful, or where I'm holding something that makes me feel like I need to hide it, that I have a group of people that I can go to and say, you know, I'm actually, if I'm telling you the truth right now, if I'm going to be honest, I'm really struggling, or this feels really hard right now, or the voice in my head is telling me I'm this awful, terrible human being. And not only doing that, but then allowing them to speak truth back over me, because we all need people sometimes to fill in the gaps and to tell us who we are, who they see us to be, in a positive and loving and kind way. And so if you have people who you know are going to do that and who are willing to do that, then let them. Like, it's, I enjoy getting to do that for other people. And so I always have to remind myself, if I enjoy getting to do that for other people, that means that other people also probably enjoy doing it for their friends too. And so if we're willing to take the leap and trust people enough to do it, then it gets easier to do it the next time. And then we don't have these secrets that are shrouded in shame, because I legitimately believe that the more that we hide something, the more shame grows around it. And then it becomes just this big, nasty ball of ugliness that's harder and harder and harder to deal with. And so if we can sort of, I don't know, get in there early and get rid of some of that initially by letting some people in on whatever the secret is, it makes it easier to deal with in the long run.
Yeah, I agree 100%. So I'm sitting here thinking about how sometimes this gets misunderstood in the church. And like one way that I'm thinking about it is sometimes we're taught that the behavior itself is the sin, or that we should be ashamed of the behavior. Mm-hmm. And that creates the shame and keeps us from wanting to tell, right?
Yeah.
But actually, I feel like what the enemy uses is the secrecy around the thing and the shame to make it much worse. And that is what ends up binding us up.
Yeah,
more so than the behavior itself. So, yeah, when he says confess to one another, there's good reasons for that. And I don't even think it's always just about sin, you know, and repentance. I think it's about like, get it out. That's what the body of Christ is for. We got to hold it for each other.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And in my experience, even though the initial push to get it out is really hard and really scary, and especially if it's the first time you're ever doing it, it's terrifying. After, it feels so much better. And then you're like, why didn't I do this sooner? Why didn't I trust somebody sooner? Like, I could have had this lighter feeling the whole time. And I mean, I look back at myself now and I'm like, what were you even doing? Like, why didn't you let somebody in earlier? But you don't know until you know. And so you just have to, you know, take the leap and try it and hope for the best in some cases and learn from experience that there actually are people who are willing to do it with you.
Yeah. I do think the whole safety thing is important, though, because I think we generally know who is and who is not safe. And we've been taught that in things that we've told them before.
Yeah.
So if it doesn't feel like we're safe enough to share, then that requires safety to get to a point that we can be vulnerable. So
for sure.
So I'm going to talk about change for a second. In my office, I don't have it here at home, but in my office at work, I have a sign that I use sometimes with people who are recovering from an addiction of some sort, but it doesn't even have to be that. It can be about like any kind of change, but it's really about the change cycle. Mm. And I think we can make a choice and like, boom, it's going to be different tomorrow. And that's what that whole January 1st deal is all about, where people make these resolutions and then can't keep them up. And so there's actually scientific research that shows that you have to pre-contemplate about it, and then you contemplate about it, and then you take an action step, and then you do the thing, but then you got to hit the maintenance phase and be able to keep that up. And most people then relapse, you know, and that can take a lot of times before it sticks. And that's for any behavior, any habit, any addiction, anything like that. And so I really, really liked what you wrote about making your own changes when it came to healing from this. You said, when you're in the thick of it and are working towards making changes, you don't need to be discouraged if those changes don't take immediately. Time spent trying isn't time wasted. It's the important work.
Yeah,
I agree completely. What has the process of trying taught you about yourself and about growth and change?
Oh, gosh, I wish that we didn't have to try so hard. I wish that the change cycle didn't exist and it was just instantaneous. That would make things so much easier in the long run. But, for me, like, this has been such an ongoing thing. You know, it's been 20 years. It's been more of my life than not at this point that, you know, I think that I at times have been really discouraged by that and thought I should be better than this. Like, I've been working at this for so long. Why haven't I figured this out? Why am I not on top of this? Why do I still have these urges? Why do I still struggle in this way? And it's really easy, or it has in the past been really easy, every time that I've had, you know, a relapse or a slip up or whatever you want to call it, to sort of be in this place of like, oh my gosh, I've blown it again. Now I'm going to have to start completely over. Everything that I did up till now was just wasted effort. And in reality, it's not like that's information that you've gathered. It was building resiliency and determination and proving to yourself that you actually can withstand that for some period of time. And so I think that over the course of really probably the last couple of years, as I have learned that and actually really started to like believe it in my bones more, I look now at time that I spend trying and go, you know, what determination and what strength it takes to continue trying, even if there's this sense that you might not cross the finish line in the way that you hoped. And if you don't cross the finish line in the way that you hoped, or if it doesn't look like what you hoped it would, or if you circle back to the beginning of the change cycle or, you know, whatever, it doesn't mean that you have failed in some way. And I think before it was always for me about failure versus success. And so now I'm like, trying is not failure, and it's not embarrassing to have tried and to have ended up back in a point where you're sort of starting over again. It's a signal that like you're doing the work, and the work is hard, and that's okay. It doesn't, if it was easy, you know, we would all just magically be healed and none of us would be having these conversations ever. And so the fact that for me, I always have to tell myself, like, the fact that I'm not superhuman and have ended up in a situation where like I actually do have to try does not speak anything negative over like who I am as a person. It just reinforces the fact that I am actually a person and I am actually a human. And that means that I deal with human things, and this is a human thing. And so because we live in the world that we live in, and things aren't perfect here, I'm going to have to try. And that trying is really just continuing to build strength for the next however many years I have on this earth, because in reality, I'm going to have to continue trying for all of them. And so it's not wasted time. It's actually time that's really well spent, hard as it may be.
Yeah, that's really good. So actually, my theme this year is about resilience. So I'm glad you brought it up. Mm-hmm. And you're right. That change cycle is really what resilience is about. It's mm-hmm. about like, how do we make it through hard things? Mm-hmm. How do we learn to tolerate distress is what Kurt Thompson says, mm-hmm. and actually grow stronger through it. That's what building muscle is about, right? Pushing ourselves to the breaking point, and then not really. We don't want to push ourselves that far, but enough that there's stress involved, right? And then build strength in the middle of that. So one thing, I'm not necessarily preaching to you, Brittany, but I'm thinking for people that are listening, one thing that might be important for them to know is that what we're talking about is building new neural networks. And if we've been relying on a particular thing that has helped us regulate in really hard times, our brain has that hardwired in like a superhighway, mm-hmm. because it's like, I want to feel better fast, mm-hmm. and this I know works. And so that's why when we're really desperate, our brain goes there immediately. Mm-hmm. And it takes a lot of work to build strong neural networks that go other places. Like that mm-hmm. doesn't come naturally, and not for a long time. And even then, in bad times, our brain remembers that superhighway it can go to. Mm-hmm. And it's there and it worked, right? It wasn't healthy, but it worked. And so there's a reason why we used that behavior, whatever that is, fill in the blank, alcohol, mm-hmm. eating, cutting, whatever, fill it mm-hmm. in. It can be anything, porn. Our phones, to be honest, is the thing most people are using these days, including myself, unfortunately. So whatever gives us relief is what I'm trying to say. Whatever gives us relief the fastest is where our brains want to go. And anything other than that requires a lot of work, and it's hard. It's just a hard path.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I saw my therapist yesterday. I still see her every week. And just yesterday I was having this conversation with her, and, you know, I was like, I'm having these urges, and it's so frustrating, and I can't believe we're having this conversation again. And oh my gosh, isn't it so annoying? And she looked at me and she was like, actually, it's a really good sign and sort of a roundabout way that you're even having these urges, because what that means is you're finally allowing yourself to feel enough to have an urge that your body is like trying to get rid of, and you're not acting on it. And so
you're talking about it.
Yeah. Like, not only are you actually feeling, which for me is what I try to avoid most of the time using self-injury. And so she's like, you're feeling, and also you're not going and doing the thing that would stop you from feeling. And so I mean, I think that this a conversation about trying and what that looks like and what resiliency looks like is really just such like a lifelong thing, no matter where you are in the process, no matter, like you were saying, what it is you're dealing with. We all have a thing, whatever it is. It just is always something we're all dealing with on some level. And the fact that you're still dealing with it is maybe in some cases a roundabout kind of good sign, because it means you're letting yourself feel enough to have something to want to avoid. So.
Yeah, that's right. You're engaging in life and responding accordingly and finding new ways of managing that. That's really good. I'm glad you shared that. Thumbs up. I like your therapist.
I like her too. I'm going to keep her.
So let me ask you, what encouragement would you give to someone who struggles with self-harm or somebody who wants to support somebody that they know who is struggling?
Yeah, that's a good question. I think that if you are somebody who is struggling with self-harm, I would say, first of all, you're not alone. You're not the only one. You're not crazy. You're not a bad person. But you don't have to struggle alone, and you don't have to struggle in that way. There are people who are willing to help. There are resources that are available. And if you are brave enough and willing to ask for that, whatever that means for you, whether it's a professional help or, you know, help from a friend or whatever, then I would really encourage you to do that, because it just makes it so much easier to not carry it alone. Like we talked about before, it just makes the biggest difference. And I know that that's a terrifying leap to make, but it in the end, if you find somebody who's a safe person, who loves you, who, you know, is capable of being there for you, it's a really, good move. And so I would just encourage you to figure out what it means for you to not have to carry it alone. And if you're somebody who loves somebody who struggles with this, I would say just meet them with curious compassion. Like, I think a lot of times people want to rush in and fix it, and they, you know, want to hide all the sharp objects, or they want to immediately send you to therapy, or, you know, whatever. And it feels really overwhelming as somebody who's being on the receiving end of that, to sort of have somebody come in just like really full throttle and sort of try to overpower or manhandle the situation, when in reality, like, most people just want to feel understood. And so even though it is scary, and I'm not trying to negate the fact it is a scary and can be a very serious thing, but if you can come in and ask questions that feel kind and curious and compassionate rather than judgmental or shameful, or, you know, like you've just discovered the worst thing ever about this person, then they're going to be a lot more willing to have a conversation with you, and a lot more open to having a conversation with you. Even if it's not right in that minute, you know, later on, they're probably going to be more willing to come back to you and have a conversation than they would be if you just come in real hot and heavy and, you know, try to solve the whole thing in the first 5 minutes after you learn about it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's really good. I'm going to share with you something that I tell people, but you can disagree with me if you want, because you've lived it.
Okay.
So I work a lot with eating disorders, and I use this in a different way with that. But I think a lot of things are helpful about thinking about them through an attachment lens, because if we're thinking about how to help somebody who's dysregulated, the number one thing that God gave us from the very beginning was somebody who will be there with us. And so we think about Christ doing that for us. And then we think about mommies doing that for three-year-olds who have hurt their knees on the playground, right? The first thing they want is mommy.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And then she puts a Band-Aid on and is there for them. And then they go back to playing. Okay. So I think about, like, with somebody who's struggling with bulimia, I'll tell the parents, like, will you sit with them for an hour after meals? Just be present with them. You guys don't have to talk about it. You can play a game. You can watch TV, whatever you need to do. But during that window, when I know that that urge is really strong, why don't you just be there with them through that? And so I think about stuff like that, too. I'll talk with my clients and their parents if it's an adolescent, let's say. If it's not, you know, I'm talking about who are your support people, and we're talking about it differently. But like, at those times when it's really strong, who is somebody who can be with you through that, or that you can call or whatever? Is that a helpful tool?
Yeah. Okay. I think it's really scary to ask for that kind of help and support. But I mean, I've had friends over the course of the last 10 or 15 years, like in college, I had a friend who would, I mean, he'd literally come pick me up and we'd just sit in his truck, and like, we wouldn't talk about it. We wouldn't do anything. We would just sit there until the urge had passed and things were feeling a little bit more stable. And that was just that was so kind and so generous of him to do. And it does help. I mean, nobody wants to feel alone when they're at like a dark, scary place. And no matter what anybody says, it is a dark and scary place to feel like you're in a place where you need to hurt yourself or you need to, you know, make yourself throw up or whatever the case may be. Like, that is a dark and scary moment. And so to have somebody who's willing to sit there with you in it and say, like, I see you and I see you as a human and I'm here and I love you and I want to be here and this doesn't scare me and I'm not going to run away and I'm not going to make you talk about it either. I'm just going to be here and be a presence for you. Like, that's such a powerful thing for sure.
Well, I really appreciate you being on the podcast. Anything that you want to say that I didn't give you a chance to?
I don't think so. I really appreciate getting to have this conversation. I think that it's a subject that a lot of people shy away from. And so I appreciate your willingness to have a conversation about it and to give other people the opportunity to like learn a little bit more about it and to hopefully help it feel less scary and overwhelming for people who maybe have somebody who's dealing with this in their lives.
Awesome. Thank you. Thanks again, Brittany, for being on today's podcast episode. I really enjoyed getting to talk to you, and I really appreciate all the wisdom that you shared. Friends, if you enjoyed this episode and you'd like to know more, I hope that you'll go check out Brittany's book, Stories Our Scars Tell. You can also find Brittany on Instagram at Brittany Tinsley Writes. She is a great follow. Well, friends, I hope you're coming away from this episode with a little more curiosity, a little more compassion for people who struggle in this area, or for yourself and in the ways that you struggle. I hope that you're remembering that we don't go from a 10 to a 1. We go a little down at a time. That's how God made our bodies. I hope that you remember how sacred you are, all the parts of you, and that healing takes time. Well, I think we're going to be having one more scripture meditation episode this season. So you can look for that in a couple of weeks. And then in the new year, I'm planning to have a 4-part episode series with a guest that I think you're really going to enjoy. So we have all that to look forward to in the future. If you're not already subscribed to PRN, Pause, Renew, Next, I hope you go find us and subscribe on your favorite podcasting app so you don't miss an episode. I'm not always putting them out once a week like I used to, but I'm still doing it. Even if it's sometimes irregular, I'm still putting them out and I don't want you to miss any episodes. I would really encourage you also to share this with your friends. You can do it over social media. You can go follow Pause Renew Next on Instagram or Facebook or Threads, any of the above, or you can check out the website pauserenewnext.com. Well, that's all for today's episode. I'm Jenny Detweiler with PRN. Pause, Renew, Next. May you be encouraged on your journey with Jesus.